Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the most important events in both California history and the history of modern seismology and plate tectonics was the Northern California earthquake, which struck at 5:12 a.m. on April 18, 1906. While many things happened in 1906, like President Theodore Roosevelt winning the Nobel Peace Prize for helping negotiate the end of a war between Japan and Russia, as well as the first legal forward pass in American football, 1906 means one thing to anyone in the geosciences or who lives in the San Francisco Bay Area: the earthquake. Over the next two episodes, we'll be joined by a team of scientists from the United States Geological Survey to look back at the Northern California quake, whose epicenter was just off the Golden Gate. There was no bridge there at the time, and coupled with massive fires, virtually destroyed the city of San Francisco. We'll also discuss how the event helped accelerate our scientific understanding of earthquakes and talk about what will happen when a magnitude 8 earthquake strikes along the San Andreas Fault again and how we can prepare for it. We don't know the exact magnitude of the 1906 quake due to the relatively primitive state of seismology then, but it's estimated to have been a 7.8, which is truly massive and right at the upper limit of what the San Andreas Fault is capable of unleashing. We also don't know exactly how many people died from the earthquake and ensuing fires, but modern estimates put the number around 3,000 for San Francisco, which at the time had a population of 400,000, and after the quake, at least half of them were left homeless. Later on in this episode, we'll find out more about the tectonics of the 1906 earthquake and the San Andreas Fault with USGS geologist Austin Elliott. We'll also find out more about the aftershocks of the 1906 quake and other earthquakes with Andrew Michael, who also wrote a fascinating piece of music to bring temblors to life for your ears and mind. But first, our guest is Susan Huff. Susan is a geophysicist at the United States Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena. Susan Huff, welcome to Blue Dot.
Happy to be here.
Well, we're having you join us to talk about everything that we've learned about the 1906 earthquake that hit Northern California and, of course, destroyed the city of San Francisco with the terrible fire. So my first question for you is, when you hear 1906, what are the first thoughts that pop into your mind as a geophysicist?
Well, to a seismologist, 1906 is shorthand. I mean, that's all you have to say, the date. And you don't even have to say San Francisco or earthquake. But it, you know, among seismologists, we just refer to 1906 because it was, and there were other earthquakes that year, but San Francisco was such a singular event that, you know, it just has, its own meaning all its own.
Yeah, and let's talk a bit about, you know, the state of seismology in 1906 or just before the earthquake. There was no huge network of seismographs, as I recall. This is the era of like smoke drum, old-fashioned seismographs. How new was that instrumentation back then?
So instrumentation to record earthquakes goes back to the early 19th century. People were playing with pendulum-type designs to respond to earthquakes. But then the development of seismometers, which actually record earthquake shaking, that didn't happen until the very end of the 19th century. And the first real seismogram, a recording of a distant earthquake, is acknowledged to be 1889. So that's not too many years before 1906. Mm-hmm. But there was development of modern seismometry. We call it the, a lot of it, the work was done in England, some in Japan, some in Europe. So by 1906, there were seismometers around the world that were able to record large earthquakes.
Yeah, and I know there were some seismographs in the Bay Area, but for a lot of them, the earthquake shaking was so bad that they literally went off the scales.
Right, so the early instrumentation was not designed to record large earthquakes on scale. It was designed to record what we call teleseism, so big earthquakes somewhere around the world generate waves that you can't feel, but a seismometer can detect them. And those were the earliest instruments. The instruments that were designed specifically to record strong shaking on scale weren't developed until about the 1930s.
Yeah, wow. So that's quite a bit after that. All right, let's talk about the earthquake itself. But before we get to that, let's talk about the cause of the earthquake, the famous San Andreas Fault. It had only been identified really just a few years prior, right?
So yeah, the story goes that Andrew Lawson identified a part of the fault through the San Francisco Peninsula. So they didn't recognize how big it was. And nobody had any idea about plate tectonics then. So that understanding that it was part of an active plate boundary, that had to wait another 50 or 60 years. But a small part of the fault, yes, had been identified. And it was important also that by 1906, scientists did understand what an earthquake is. And that may sound like a funny statement, but for a long time, the word earthquake referred to the earth quaking. That was the first thing that people were aware of, that, hey, the ground shaking. But they didn't know for a long time why the ground was shaking. And there were a lot of theories that involved underground explosions of various sorts. And those theories held sway through about 1890. So the association between earth shaking and fault movement really only was developed around 1890, 1891. But by 1906, the scientists did understand that faults move and that's why the ground shakes. So that was an important bit of context because it let scientists go out and really understand what they were looking at.
Let's talk about the San Andreas Fault, you know, from our perspective here, you know, with what we know about it. Tell us about the tectonic setting of the San Andreas Fault and, you know, characterize it for us in Northern California.
Sure. So we now know that the Earth's crust is broken up into these large pieces we call plates that move around relative to one another. They move about as fast as your fingernails grow. So it's not speedy fast, but you can actually monitor the motion now with modern GPS instruments. And the San Andreas Fault is the main plate boundary fault between the Pacific plate, which goes all the way to Japan, the other side of the ocean, and the North American plate. And along that part of the plate boundary, the plates are moving sideways relative to one another. So we know now that the San Andreas Fault, it's a plate boundary and one where the plates are moving sideways as opposed to vertically.
Yeah, and it's a what's called a right lateral strike slip fault. So like, for example, if you stand on the North American side, the eastern side of the fault, and you look across at the western side, the Pacific plate, if there's a fault movement, you're going to see that other side move to your right. And the same thing would be conversely true if you stood on the other side and looked the other way, it would appear to move to your right. So that's why it's called a right lateral fault.
Yeah, it's sort of nice that, right, it works no matter which side you're on.
Yeah.
The sense of motion is the same. So yes, we call it right lateral.
Okay, well, let's talk about the earthquake itself. Walk us through, you know, what the moment of rupture would be like for an earthquake like that in 1906, because that's a very large magnitude earthquake. Is it 7.9? Is that what's been settled on as the magnitude for 1906?
Yes, is the short answer. So the people have looked very carefully at the available data, which of course are way more limited than for a modern earthquake, but they've looked very carefully to try to pinpoint the nucleation point or the epicenter. And it's now, the most recent result was that it was slightly offshore of the Golden Gate Ridge. So the San Andreas Fault doesn't pass directly under the Golden Gate, but it's just offshore. And that's believed to be the nucleation point. And then some earthquakes start and the fault break goes in one direction only. The 1906 appears to have gone, the fault broke in both directions once it started to move. So the fault break, a fault doesn't slip all at once. It starts somewhere. It's like a ripple in a carpet. If you hold on a carpet and you put a ripple in, it would travel along the floor. So the rupture, the break, travels along the fault about 2 to 3 kilometers a second. So that's pretty fast.
That's fast.
Yeah. And in this case, went in both directions. The break kept going down to about around San Juan Bautista to the south, near a zone where the San Andreas is able to creep slowly, and it's thought to not be accumulating stress. So the rupture kind of, it's like it hit a soggy sponge and it wasn't able to go through. That's a pretty loose analogy. And then to the north, it kept going all the way up to...
Cape Mendocino?
Yeah, near Cape Mendocino. And that's around where the plate boundary transitions to a more complicated zone and stops being a right lateral system. So the San Andreas goes from pretty much the almost the extent of California, from near the Mexican border to the south, all the way up to Cape Mendocino and offshore. And we think it has two main segments, the northern segment from the creeping segment section to Cape Mendocino, and then the southern section starts below the creeping section around Parkfield and goes down to the to near the Mexico border.
Down in the Salton Trough area.
Yes. I mean, it was about 400 kilometers, so a very long rupture.
That is huge, you know, and that's what a lot of people, when they hear 1906, they just think of San Francisco, but this truly affected a huge swath of Northern California.
Yeah, it is. It's impressive to think about how big that fault break was. There weren't a lot of people living along parts of it, which kept the damage and the impact from being even worse. And parts of California today are not all that densely populated along parts of the San Andreas, which is fortunate. But yeah, it was, you know, very long. It wasn't super deep, the fault break, but it shook pretty much the entire state and into neighboring states at magnitude 7.9. It was a major earthquake, obviously.
Yeah. And do you know, what was the duration of the shaking?
So you can sort of do the math. If it's 400 kilometers and the break is moving at, say, 3 kilometers per second, you know, that means the fault is actually moving for over 2 minutes. From the time it starts to break until the fault stops at both ends, there is a full 2 minutes. And so that has important implications. The shaking that you feel comes from the fault motion and then the waves spread out. So the shaking that you feel is generally a lot longer than the actual fault motion. But if the fault motion was 2 minutes, you know, people were feeling shaking for, you know, quite a bit longer than that.
Wow. Yeah, that's a long time. You know, compared to, like, for example, if people remember the Loma Prieta earthquake in October of 1989, the shaking there lasted only seconds. You know, so it's hard to imagine what that kind of intense shaking over minutes, that is just hard to imagine.
Yeah, indeed. And so Loma Prieta, say it was 20 kilometers long about. So 1906 was kind of like 20 Loma Prietas laid end to end. And in fact, it was worse than that because the nature of the shaking was different.
Characterize how it was different?
So you can think of an earthquake as a symphony that releases energy with a range of frequencies or musical tones. And the bigger the earthquake, it's like the bigger the instrument, the deeper the tones that are released. So a bigger earthquake releases these booming low tones. And people who feel earthquakes will sort of know what I'm talking about. That's the energy that just feels like it's picking up your house and shaking it back and forth and very... very dramatic. So that kind of energy, and now it's energy that can shake tall buildings or bridges, is going to come from the biggest earthquakes. So an earthquake like 1906, it's like 20 Loma Prietas laid end to end, but it's worse than that because you've turned up the amplifier on the low tones.
And I remember reading some eyewitness accounts, and many people said the sound came first, and
yeah,
compared it to the sound I read of like a thousand roaring lions, and you know, it's like whoa, and then the shaking started. That sounds just oof. That would be frightening.
So faults release different types of waves as they break, and the fastest of them is the P wave or the pressure wave, which is basically a sound wave traveling through the solid earth. And then for a very large earthquake, that can generate a sound wave in the air. So you won't necessarily hear an earthquake if the shaking isn't strong or the earthquake isn't close. But if you're right on top of a big earthquake, then you commonly do hear the sounds from the earthquake itself.
And since it was offshore, you know, underwater, you know, a lot of people might be wondering, well, you know, why wasn't there a tsunami? Because we, you know, have learned to associate earthquakes and tsunamis. Of course, the type of fault that the San Andreas is not the kind that would generate tsunamis. But was there any kind of strange, you know, wave tidal behavior from this huge event?
There was a very minor tsunami that was documented. I believe it was on the order of 10 centimeters. And to generate a wave in the water, you have to push the energy into the water itself. And if a fault moves laterally, it's shearing. You can't shear water. To generate a tsunami, you need to move the seafloor vertically. And then you drop the seafloor typically or raise it and you push the water column up, and that's what generates a tsunami. And so it wasn't the kind of earthquake that's going to, as you say, generate a large tsunami. You may, if you have an underwater or even onshore earthquake that moves laterally, you can get minor tsunamis a couple of ways. You can cause slumping offshore, and then your material slumps underwater, and you can actually generate significant local tsunamis that way. Or a fault that moves mostly sideways can have a little bit of vertical motion as well along the way. And I believe that's what the thinking is for 1906, that there were, the fault isn't a perfect knife edge like you see in textbook cartoons. It's got some complexity to it.
I've often wondered, and especially with a quake of that magnitude, that much rupture and that much motion, if you could have a drone flying, say we had a drone in 1906 and you could be like over the land part of the fault, what would you see?
Yeah, I've thought about that too. So there are a very few observations like that. Now, 3 kilometers per second, that is very fast. So it would look like a very fast tear across the landscape. The other thing you're going to see, though, is typically a lot of landsliding. If there's hills anywhere nearby, you kick up massive amounts of dust. If there's a built environment and there's damage, there's massive amounts of dust.
Thanks to our guest, geophysicist from the United States Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena, Susan Huff. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look back at the massive 1906 earthquake that struck Northern California. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot's special look back and forward at the impact of the 1906 earthquake that led to the virtual destruction of San Francisco and wreaked havoc throughout Northern California. Joining us now is Austin Elliott. Austin is a research geologist at the USGS Earthquake Science Center and researches the record of earthquakes and faulting on the landscape. Austin Elliott, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I've asked this to all of our guests on this special program, but when I say 1906, what are the first thoughts that pop into your mind?
The big one. I think for us here in Northern California, that really is kind of the extreme case of the largest earthquake that we can expect. And it's remarkable that it's remarkable that it was experienced historically in a relatively modern city.
And let's talk about the actual rupture of the San Andreas Fault, because that's something that you know quite a bit about. Talk about the nature of how it broke and why that was peculiar and why it was, caused such a big earthquake.
The 1906 rupture, it was a magnitude 7.9 earthquake. That's about as large as they get on strike slip fault systems. Those are the types of tectonic boundaries that slide horizontally past each other rather than converging or extending. This is the two pieces gliding, sliding, or maybe more violently grinding past each other. And at the time of the 1906 earthquake, that sort of motion was fairly inconceivable. The conception geologists had of how the Earth worked tectonically, how it moved, how rocks got to where they are on the planet, was really centered around vertical motions, erosion and readjustment up and down. Faults were recognized, these cracks in the rocks along which they would slide or break or move, but it was generally understood that the motion that happened on them was mostly vertical. And the 1906 earthquake really changed that understanding fundamentally and set the stage for our modern understanding of plate tectonics.
I'm interested in the actual rupture itself and the surface appearances of that rupture. And I know that's something that you study contemporarily.
The 1906 earthquake is the quintessential example of a strike slip rupture. And so the sides of the fault moved a tremendous amount past each other along an enormous length of this fault line, a distance of something over 400 miles. Everything along the fault between San Juan Bautista and Humboldt or Cape Mendocino basically slid past each other by between 2 and 20 feet. That left a really tremendous scar along the whole landscape. And so if you were trying to cross the San Francisco Peninsula or trying to head out to Point Reyes Peninsula, you would have to cross this fault. And every road, every fence line, every property boundary that straddled the fault had been severed and slid 10 feet to the right, no matter which side of it you're standing on. What that leaves is a really impactful impression of geological forces and how they move the Earth.
Are there places you can still go and see the signs from 1906, you know, where you could go out in the field and see features, or have they pretty much been covered up?
There are quite a few places in Northern California where you can go and you can certainly see the escarpment left where this crack slid, where the ground was wrenched apart during the earthquake. There are places where you can see offset fences, offset property lines. I think in general, they're kind of recreations. It's been almost 120 years since the earthquake. Wooden fences out in the forest don't necessarily last that long. And so some of them have been recreated for a dramatic or illustrative effect, but they do represent the original observations, which were well documented at the time of the earthquake. And so there are plenty of places near Olema. If you go to Point Reyes, there's some along the San Francisco Peninsula up in the mountains, sort of Los Trancos wilderness. You'll find places where you can look at offset fences and their sort of interpretive trails where you can go back and revisit immediate effects of this earthquake, really see plate tectonics in action.
Well, for those of us alive now that, you know, we certainly weren't around in 1906, a lot of us have experienced, you know, what we think of as large earthquakes, like perhaps Loma Prieta in 1989. But from your perspective, looking back at 1906, the earthquakes we think of as big, they really aren't when you put them in perspective. Could you comment on that?
That's right. The difference between a magnitude 6 and 7 is huge, and the difference between a magnitude 7 and 8 is a really tremendous difference in the experience of the earthquake. The duration of an earthquake like 1906, something that's approaching a magnitude 8, the main difference between that and a magnitude 7.1, 7.2, which are big earthquakes in their own right, the main difference that arises is the length of the fault that ruptures, and that translates directly to the duration of the earthquake, the duration of shaking that you experience where you are. And so going through an earthquake that's in the high magnitude sevens, the shaking is going to last for over a minute. And that's something that's really different than the kind of 15 to 20 seconds that feels like a lifetime of the earthquakes that we're sort of familiar with in California in recent memory. And it's going to make a scarier experience than a lot of people, I think, are prepared for. An important thing to know about it also is that you don't know how hard the shaking is going to be. You can't second guess the earth. You can't predict what it's going to do. And the hardest shaking in these events may come late in the process. You may be experiencing strong shaking for a long time, and then it gets stronger. And so this is why we propagate this advice and try to get everyone to really understand that the right approach during an earthquake is to drop where you are, get yourself under cover, and to hold on, because the shaking can be violent and it can get violent in a sudden and unpredictable way.
Well, let's talk about the future of the San Andreas Fault in Northern California, because really it's not just the main trace of the fault. It's a system of faults, because they splay off into several different faults like the Hayward and Calaveras and so on. Talk about what the future could look like. What are the probabilities of something like 1906 or something very different happening?
Well, yeah, what we know about this fault system is that future generations will see further earthquakes like 1906. But as you point out, the San Andreas is not a lone actor. The plate boundary is this whole series of split up, splintered geological blocks, and they're separated by other substantial faults that are threatening in their own right. So the Hayward Fault, that's the next one east of the San Andreas. It runs up the densely populated East Bay. It's really, in the scheme of the world, one of the most imposing sort of faults because of the way it has been totally built over. And so when it produces another earthquake in the future, as we know it will, it's going to have some pretty substantial impacts just because of how much is built on top of it, how many things cross it, BART, highways, pipelines of water, the distribution system of water from Hetch Hetchy Reservoir into the Bay Area. All these things cross that fault, and they have to deal with it potentially moving in the future. The San Andreas Fault is the longest, straightest, and fastest moving of these faults, so it can produce the really, really large ones, like magnitude 7.9, and we know it may do so in the future. I guess, somewhat fortunately, in our case, it already did that fairly recently. And so we don't necessarily expect it to produce it. It won't be able to produce another earthquake of quite that magnitude for at least sort of half a century or so, we expect. Other faults in the region, however, it's been longer since they last produced a large earthquake, and they're more or less ready to produce their next one. So while 1906 was this really exceptional event, there are plenty of potential magnitude 7 earthquakes waiting along any of these other fault systems. We do calculations based on the geologic record of earthquakes, how often we can identify them having occurred in the past, the sizes of those in the past, the lengths of the fault that ruptured in each of those earthquakes. We put all that information together along with modern measurements of the number of earthquakes there are, as well as, you know, literal determinations of tectonic plate velocities. You know, we can measure the ongoing motion of the tectonic plates. And so we know how much strain is built up on these faults. And we know that they're capable of producing magnitude 7 and above earthquakes. We just don't know exactly when it's going to happen and which fault will be the next one to break.
Yeah, but even like a magnitude 6.5 is a large earthquake, and happening on one of these faults in very densely populated areas would be, you know, a major disaster.
That's exactly right. And the reality that we face in the Bay Area and Northern California more broadly is that many of these faults are basically primed to go. The Hayward Fault, the last time it had an earthquake was 1868, and its recurrence interval on average is about a century and a half. So we're certainly within the window at which we expect it to be ready to produce the next earthquake. And what that means for us is that, and I'm sure you've heard this year in and year out, but it really could be this very afternoon or tomorrow. But it could also be years out. These geological processes are much larger than our human timescales. And so there's a pretty big uncertainty on when they're going to happen. But the larger earthquakes are more devastating, but some of those smaller ones. If you get down below magnitude 7, something like a magnitude 6, 6.5, those happen almost 10 times as frequently as the large ones. And they're really damaging and destructive in their own right, although over a smaller scale. You can point to fairly good examples of these, such as the 2014 South Napa earthquake, which near its epicenter was particularly damaging. And people really had to deal with the aftermath of that really locally in Napa. There are plenty of other examples of earthquakes like that that have sort of hit one-off communities around the area. And we can expect many more of those in addition to sort of that ultimate real big one that impacts a much broader region.
Well, finally, for somebody like you who's a research geologist, and definitely you were not around in 1906, I'm pretty sure you're not that old. I don't think anybody is now. But are there still things that you can learn from 1906, looking at old seismograms or data or anything? Are there things still that you can tease out?
Well, the legacy of the 1906 earthquake is really well cemented as this foundation of modern plate tectonics. But there are a couple of sort of modern research focuses that are pretty relevant to what we learned in the 1906 earthquake. You mentioned the numerous faults and splays of faults around the Bay Area. We are still working to understand how these faults interact with each other, where exactly they are, where do they intersect, when a future earthquake happens, which of the faults will be activated, can they work together, will a rupture as it propagates along the fault, will it jump from one fault to an adjacent fault? These are outstanding questions that we're currently working on trying to understand, both from the geologic record of prior earthquakes and how they've behaved or appear to have behaved in the past in the landscape record, as well as tackling that problem with modeling and computer simulations of the physical process of earthquake rupture. So understanding how the fault system interacts is really a big open question that not all earthquakes are as simple as the 1906 earthquake was in hindsight. And we're trying to sort of incorporate that information into our forecasts of seismic hazard. The other big outstanding question that is of great relevance to sort of society and the infrastructure that supports us is exactly what it looks like at the fault when the rupture happens. Of course, the 1906 rupture sort of seeded these ideas of horizontal fault slip and plate tectonics. And there's great documentation of that rift, how much the sides slid. But these days, there's a great deal of focus on just exactly how much will the sides of a fault slide? How wide will the zone of deformation be within them? Because it's relevant when we have things like rail lines, highways, infrastructure, pipelines that cross these faults and that have to in order to sort of serve our big population here. We're able to build to accommodate fault slip, but we need to anticipate how wide a zone to expect and how much slip to expect when the earthquake does happen.
Well, Austin Elliott, research geologist from the USGS Earthquake Science Center, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us on 1906 and the San Andreas Fault and its various neighboring faults in the Bay Area.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guest, USGS research geologist Austin Elliott. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue Blue Dot's special two-part look back and forward at the lessons learned and unresolved questions from the 1906 earthquake in Northern California. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Hey And we're back, and thanks for listening to part one of Blue Dot's special two-part look at the impacts of Northern California's 1906 earthquake, both on the region and on the science of seismology. Our next guest is an expert on aftershocks and major quakes, and he has also created a unique piece of audio art to help us connect with the Earth's uneasy harmonies during and after an earthquake. Andrew Michael is a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey Science Center at Moffett Field in the Bay Area, and he joins us now. Andy Michael, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for having me on.
So when, and I've asked this for all our guests, and I'll ask you too, when I say 1906, what are the first things that pop into your mind?
So as a seismologist, the thing that pops into my mind is this is really the first earthquake where it was well established that the earthquake was caused by slippage on the fault, that we actually saw the fault. The idea that faults were causing earthquakes was starting to circulate, and this earthquake gave us the observations to really see that in detail.
And you mentioned to me in an email that you cross the fault on your way to work every day, right?
That's right. So I actually live on the San Mateo County coastside in Half Moon Bay, and my office now is at Moffett Field in Mountain View. And if people are familiar with Highway 280 running up and down the peninsula, there's a series of very long lakes. They're actually reservoirs. And the San Andreas Fault runs right under them. And I cross them on a little sort of land bridge every day. And that land bridge actually was deflected and deformed in the 1906 earthquake. And we have photographs of that in the historic record.
Yeah, I've seen those. And when you cross it, I'm just curious, does it enter your mind every time that, you know, yep, crossing over the fault?
Well, I've been here for over 30 years. So I'm not sure it's every time, but often.
Yeah.
And because, yeah, it's exciting. I mean, I live on the Pacific Plate. I don't live in North America.
Wow. Yeah, no, that is cool. Okay, well, I want to talk to you specifically about your work on aftershocks and seismology. But before we get to that, you did a really interesting project where you combine music with seismology. Tell us a bit about the genesis of that. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I was working on a very interesting type of seismic waves that are trapped within the very weak material that is in and surrounds a fault zone. They're called trapped waves. And it occurred to me at the time that playing trombone, that I was also doing something very similar. I was making waves in the very weak air that's inside the brass tubing of the trombone. And so I started thinking about those analogies and realized that there were a lot of ways that I could relate what I do as a seismologist, where what we do is we listen to the waves of the earth and we try to extract information about two things. One is the source of the earthquake, and the other is the path that those waves then travel through the earth to get to our seismometers. So it's source and path. What I do when I play trombone is exactly the reverse process. I manipulate the source, which is buzzing my lips in the mouthpiece, and the path, which is moving the slide on the trombone, to make waves that come out and that people then hear as music. So I was doing a lot of talking about this, using that analogy to teach people about earth seismology, when I talked about this at a arts and science conference. And the artists there, the musicians there said, you know, you need to also turn this around and use the sounds you're making from seismograms. What we do is we take the seismograms and we speed them up so we can actually hear them when we play them out through a loudspeaker. You should take those sounds and create music with them. And so I created the Earthquake Quartet number one, which is a exploration both of sort of this cyclical nature of the earthquake process, that the stress builds up in the earth and then gets released, builds up again and gets released, as well as the fact that small earthquakes are always happening in the background of our lives. And if we don't pay attention to them, we will be surprised by those large earthquakes when they happen.
Well, let's have Matt Fidler, our producer, play the Earthquake Quartet number one.
Part of the quartet we're listening to now is where the earthquakes are playing in the background underneath civilization, which is represented by the trombone, the cello, and the voice. Also seismologist David Shaft on cello and Stephanie Ross, the geophysicist, on voice. And the earthquakes are the percussion in the background. And those are actually real seismograms of small earthquakes that have been sped up and played through a loudspeaker so we can hear them. At the beginning, we also heard these sort of sliding glissandos that were in dissonance and tension with each other, and that was the process of stress building up in the earth. And as the quartet goes on, we keep continually hearing these small earthquakes in the back. And really, a lot of our lives in California are formed by the landscape that was itself formed by earthquakes. So earthquakes really are the background of our life. But if we don't pay attention, eventually we get surprised by a large one, as happens at the end of this piece. And the musicians aren't even actually supposed to know exactly when that's happening. They're supposed to play as if they don't know it's going to happen.
I really enjoyed that. I thought that was really cool.
So that surprise really happened in 1906, because there was actually a large earthquake, magnitude 6.8, that struck the San Francisco region on October 21st, 1868. So on the order of 40 years earlier. It was on the Hayward Fault in the San Francisco East Bay, but it did enough damage around the region that it was actually known as the Great San Francisco Earthquake. And there was discussion in the newspapers about the need to build earthquake-resistant buildings. And those lessons were basically all forgotten for 40 years until 1906 drove them home again. And so this is really one of the lessons, is we have to keep learning from the past and then realize that due to this cycle, that tension we heard in the music, earthquakes are going to happen again. This isn't something we can put behind us.
Yes, that is indeed the lesson of 1906 and 1989 and 1994. So, you know, many of the earthquakes in California. Let's talk about aftershocks, because there's something that you specifically work on. Can you tell us what were the aftershocks like for 1906? Because it was such a big rupture and such a big quake.
So I think the notable thing about the aftershocks for 1906 is that they are very spread out. So, of course, the earthquake itself began near San Francisco, but then ran south towards San Juan Bautista along the fault, and also north towards the Mendocino Triple Junction, a little bit south of Eureka, California. So it's not surprising that we also had aftershocks through that whole region. So there was actually, we estimated a magnitude 6.7 aftershock that happened near Cape Mendocino, actually a few years later in 1909. But aftershock sequences aren't just the next day or week. They actually can last for years. And there were also a magnitude 5.6 that actually happened near San Juan Bautista. And that was actually in May 1906, so fairly soon afterwards. I think the thing that's perhaps more surprising to people is that there were actually some aftershocks up to magnitude 6.1 in Southern California, near Brawley, Southern California, near Santa Monica Bay. There was a magnitude 5, and those happened fairly soon after 1906. So we're pretty confident they're related. It's sort of surprising because we think about 1906 as being a Northern California event, but aftershocks will happen up to 1 to 2 fault lengths away from the earthquake. So if you go from San Juan Bautista to Cape Mendocino, where the earthquake two endpoints are, that's about 300 miles. If you then take 300 to 600 miles south of San Juan Bautista, you easily encompass Southern California. So when we have another 1906 type earthquake sometime in the future, it wouldn't be surprising if we actually have some aftershocks in Southern California. Similarly, if we have what we call the 1857 Fort Tejon earthquake, which is sort of a similarly large earthquake in Southern California on the San Andreas Fault, it would not be surprising if we had some aftershocks up here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Wow, that's fascinating that they translate all the way along the fault like that. I'd never really connected that those earthquakes were aftershocks of 1906. That's really interesting.
Well, I think the thing you can sort of think of is you had a piece of rubber and you put a slit in it to represent the fault. And then you sort of move the rubber across that fault. It's going to deform the rest of the rubber. It's not just going to be right in that area. The elastic forces will spread out through the rest of the rubber. They do die away with distance, but it's a pretty long distance.
Well, let's talk about forecasting for the future. When you talk about aftershock sequences for a large earthquake, it's important to know that those are coming because they can be so dangerous because you got buildings that are already damaged, rescue crews that are perhaps trying to extricate people, that kind of thing going on, and then an aftershock hit. So can you tell us a bit about like what might be expected and what can you do now with the USGS, with your modern instrumentation, to forecast aftershocks for a large event like this in California?
So what we do actually after any earthquake in the US and its territories that's over magnitude 5 is we issue aftershock forecasts starting 20 minutes after the earthquake has occurred. And those give the expected number and the probability of at least one of earthquakes of magnitude 3 or greater. Now, we do that because earthquakes of that size are easily felt, and we want people to know what they're going to be feeling, because feeling a lot of aftershocks can be very emotionally disturbing, even if those particular aftershocks are not doing damage. But we also forecast the larger earthquakes, such as magnitudes 4, 5, 6s, and 7s, which will do damage, especially as they get larger. Magnitude 5s may do some damage nearby, 6s in a slightly larger regions. A 7, as we know from, say, Loma Prieta, can do damage over, you know, an entire region, such as the San Francisco Bay Area. And so we try to give people an idea of what might be coming. We make those forecasts for the next day, week, month, and year. Now, of course, right away, as people are going through the rescue operations, what happens the next day or the next week is critical to know about. We need to know when we can re-enter buildings to inspect them. We need to know what sort of risks we're placing our first responders at. But then the aftershocks will go on for years, and we need to incorporate their hazards into our recovery and rebuilding efforts. So for instance, maybe you're repairing a building and you're putting up scaffolding around it. Well, you might want to take into account the risk from aftershocks to that scaffolding, which might be up for a period of months or even a year. And so these are sort of some of the uses we see for aftershock forecasts.
Well, before we let you go, I'm curious as to, during your career, tell us a bit about how statistical modeling has really, you know, advanced in recent years with, you know, modern computational power and all of the sensor instruments we have here in California, for example.
So the models we use now for forecasting aftershocks were really created in the late 1980s, both by Paul Riesenberg and Lucy Jones at the USGS, and also by Ogata-san in Japan, who created the model we use the most these days, which is the epidemic type aftershock sequence. And that's a model in which every earthquake, including the aftershocks, because they're just earthquakes themselves, can create its own aftershocks. It's a very powerful model. It's very much like an epidemic that we just all lived through it with COVID, where each person who gets sick can create other people who get sick. That model has proven to be very powerful. We actually still use the Riesenberg and Jones model for a lot of our forecasts because it's actually simpler and more stable. We're moving towards using this epidemic type model because it's more complete. And the way the sensors work into that is by having catalogs of earthquakes in real time that show us the small earthquakes, we can observe how the sequence is evolving and factor that into our models. So I said that we make our first forecast 20 minutes after the earthquake. At that point, the only thing we really know about is the main shock. So those forecasts are based on our past experiences of observing aftershock sequence in that region or around the world in similar regions. But as the sequence goes on, we start incorporating the observations of that sequence. Because we now, and especially in regions like California with very advanced seismic networks, we almost immediately know about earthquakes down to magnitude 2. And so we can factor that myriad of observations into our models and very quickly make them more specific to the ongoing sequence.
And finally, what do you find most rewarding about your work as a geophysicist and a seismologist with the USGS?
I really find two things rewarding. Honestly, I am a pure scientist at heart, and I love just learning things. But the fact that when I learn those things, we can then apply them to help people cope and recover from earthquakes and also prepare for earthquakes in the future, that's really satisfying. I felt when I was growing up that I really wanted to find a science where not only was I studying something fascinating, something really larger than ourselves, and earthquakes and plate tectonics, which were really just coming into view at that point, definitely much bigger than we are as humans, but that those earthquakes have an impact on our human lives, and being able to use my science to make those lives better is what really drove me into this field.
Well, Andy Michael from the U.S. Geological Survey, thanks for sharing your expertise with us and your music.
Great. Okay. I'm happy to do that.
Thanks again to all our guests from the United States Geological Survey, geophysicist Susan Huff, research geologist Austin Elliott, and seismologist Andrew Michael. And a special thank you to Paul Laustsen from the USGS Public Affairs Office for helping to coordinate our interview guests. You can learn more about earthquakes and earthquake science at usgs.gov. Be sure and tune in next time when Blue Dot concludes our two-part look at the 1906 Northern California earthquake. We'll look at how earthquakes affect us on a human level, as well as how modern technology employed by the USGS and many public agencies can help us prepare for the next time the Earth violently moves under our feet. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. On our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.